Today, as the government considers tougher lockdown restrictions, we look at the only way out of this crisis. The last 12 months have seen incredible scientific breakthroughs. Never before have vaccines been conceived, developed, tested, and approved at this speed. But they still can't come fast enough.
Maria Patricio has volunteered to become one of the first people in the world to receive an experimental coronavirus vaccine, which, if successful, could put an end to the worst global pandemic in a century.
Unless we act, we could see deaths in this country running at several thousand a day, a peak of mortality, alas, bigger than the one we saw in April.
Oxford University says its vaccine is well tolerated in older adults and, crucially, that it induces a robust immune response similar to that found in younger people.
I would say go for it. Go for it because it's free. And it's the best thing that's ever happened.
It looks like such a small thing, just having that jab in the arm, but it means so much because this is the route out of this pandemic, and by God, we need one.
Our scientists have confirmed this new variant is between 50 and 70% more transmissible. That means you're much, much more likely to catch the virus and to pass it on. As I speak to you tonight, our hospitals are under more pressure from COVID than at any time since the start of the pandemic.
The Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency has now, on the basis of the advice of its scientific body, the Commission on Human Medicines, approved the COVID-19 vaccine developed by AstraZeneca and Oxford University here in the UK.
Vaccine means everything to me. I mean, to my mind, it's the only way of getting back to a bit of normal life.
If we're asking the British public to endure this, we have got to have that vaccine programme rolled out at speed. Now, that is a challenge and a half.
Seven mass vaccination centres are opening across England this morning as the government increases its effort to protect 50 million of the most vulnerable people by the middle of next month.
The next few weeks are going to be the worst weeks of this pandemic in terms of numbers into the NHS.
It's still the case, as I talked to you today, that the UK has done more vaccinations than any other country in Europe, but we cannot be complacent.
We can't have the Prime Minister over-promising and under-delivering. We've all got to play our part in that. We need a massive programme of volunteers. We need a vaccination centre on every high street.
Vaccines give clear hope for the future, but for now, you must all stay home, protect the NHS. Save lives.
This week, the government has promised to ramp up its efforts to vaccinate the country against COVID-19. It says that by the end of the week, jabs will be available at more than 1,000 GP surgeries and 200 community pharmacies, as well as at mass vaccination centres. Meanwhile, 80,000 people have been trained to administer the injections. It sounds good, but this government has made so many missteps in its response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Can it get this one right? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, vaccinating our way out of the COVID crisis. Robin McKee, as Observer Science Editor, you've obviously been tracking the development of all the vaccines. We've previously talked about the RNA technology in the Pfizer vaccine.
Today I'm delighted to inform the House that the MHRA has issued the clinical authorisation of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. This is a monumental step forward.
But the one that many more of us are going to get is the Oxford-AstraZeneca one that uses a weakened version of a cold virus in a chimpanzee.
Scientists at Oxford University have combined some of the coronavirus's genetic material with a harmless version of a common cold virus, which is highly effective at infecting human cells and stimulating an immune response.
Take me into the lab. How are these vaccines made?
The Oxford AstraZeneca is made by standard procedure where you add in a virus from a chimp and you disable it. You take out a couple of its genes that allow it to replicate, You, in the place, you put the gene that makes bits of the spike protein of the coronavirus. And you put this back together. This new virus cannot grow because you've disabled it. So you put it in a cellular medium where the bits that you've taken out, the proteins that you've disabled from it, are in the medium there, and it will grow happily in the presence of these cells. And you make billions of samples of this. Then you break open everything, extract all the cellular rubbish and everything else, and you've got billions of copies of this genetically modified virus. And you then clean it up. You add an adjuvant, put in things that will actually help it stimulate an immune response from the patient you're putting it in. And then you place it in vials, and these are the vials that are then shipped out and given to doctors, given to hospitals, ready to be given.
And you've been speaking to people who work in those labs, haven't you? What did they tell you?
They've got the ability to make it, and they're very confident they can get it out. It's up to the government, the logistics, to make sure that what they produce will get to where it's got to go.
So these vaccines have to go from the lab to be packaged, to be regulated, and then they get into people's arms. What are the potential delays in that process?
The potential delays are actual physical things. The number of vials you've got, the number of chemicals that you use to stabilise the vaccine. Every batch has to be tested and regulated. It takes 20 days, but that's fine. It's all part of the flow if you've got it properly planned. So all these things are potential hiccups in the supply chain.
And do we know how much they can actually produce? How much of the Oxford AstraZeneca one is available at the moment?
I mean, there are millions of doses there ready to come out. For the Pfizer, we've ordered 40 million doses in total, and we've about 11, 12 million jabs of these have got to be done in the next 5 or 6 weeks, which means between 2 million and 2.5 million doses a week. It's quite a push.
And in fact, Public Health England has said it's working 24/7 with providers and has so far delivered 100% of NHS orders in full and on time. But obviously, the next process is getting it actually into people's arms. How is the government prioritising who gets the vaccine?
Right. It's people over 80 and in hospital, care home residents, about 400,000 people at that, frontline health staff, about 3 million, and care home workers. They're the first to get who are going to be vaccinated.
And I have no doubt that we have enough supply to vaccinate these four groups by the February the 15th deadline. And we also have the distributional network to do it and to continue an expanding programme down that priority list.
In total, there's 9 priority groups. People over 75 are the next group, people over 70 in the group after that. And in the end, about 14 million people in England, the four highest groups, should get done by mid-February.
And do you know whether people can just go and get one if they're in those priority groups, or do they have to wait to be contacted?
They have to wait to be contacted. You have to be told to come for an appointment. You can't just turn up and say, give me a vaccine.
And in terms of the priority, they've obviously put much more emphasis on age, even than people who were told to shield, who were clinically vulnerable but who are younger. What is the science behind that? Why have they chosen it that way?
This is a virus that kills old people, and being old is the number one weakness that you can have.
And just to remind you of the importance of these groups for fighting the disease, they account for 88% of all those who have sadly lost their lives.
If you're ill and younger and you're still being shielded, you're still not quite as much as risk as somebody who is over 80. It's as simple as that.
There have unquestionably been some problems in the first few weeks of the vaccine rollout. You had the scene recently of the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, turning up at a GP surgery in North London, effectively for a photo op, and then being told that they hadn't received that day's delivery.
Dr. Hughes asked him for regular delivery slots. She told us yesterday they could be immunising 500 patients a day, but supply issues are hampering her efforts.
Elsewhere, some have talked about a postcode lottery. For example, Salford in Greater Manchester had no vaccines at all delivered between Christmas and last Tuesday. A senior member of the council talked about teething issues.
She's not alone. Dozens of GPs have complained of deliveries being cancelled or delayed at short notice.
But now the government has made clear that it is accelerating the speed of the rollout, opening 7 mass vaccination centres, and this week laying out a new plan for how to hit its targets.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Downing Street for today's coronavirus press briefing. Before I turn to our vaccine delivery plan, which we've published today, I wanted to go through the latest coronavirus data.
Already, the numbers being vaccinated have risen dramatically.
So far, across the UK, we've given 2.6 million doses to 2.3 million people. And we've protected more people through vaccinations than all other countries in Europe put together.
But Labour leader Keir Starmer thinks more is needed. He's calling for jabs to be administered 24 hours a day.
We need round-the-clock vaccine programmes, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in every village, in every town, every high street and every GP surgery.
The government's current line is that there is not a clamour for vaccine appointments outside of 8am and 8pm. OK, so if you get one of these vaccines, what protection is offered by the first dose?
Right, if you get the Pfizer vaccine, it's about 90% and about 70% if you're given the Oxford. I mean, that's good. I think that would be much more than people thought we would get from vaccines if you'd asked them, you know, 6 months ago.
What do those efficacy numbers mean to an individual?
It means that if you get a first dose of the Pfizer vaccine, 90% of those people who get the first dose of the Pfizer vaccine do not go on to suffer any serious effects. That's what they mean by 90% effectiveness. So your chances of coming in contact with the coronavirus and becoming infected, your chance of suffering serious consequences are reduced tenfold.
Those are obviously great figures, but the government has decided to delay giving the second dose of the vaccine, hasn't it? So people might now have to wait 12 weeks in between jabs, when before they would have had to wait 3 weeks for the Pfizer jab at least.
Tim Davies left home today thinking he'd be getting the first of 2 doses of the Pfizer vaccine. He was devastated when he got to the clinic and was told his second jab, set for 21 days' time, had been postponed.
I was quietened. I'm not sure that this regime is the one that the regulatory authority sanctioned when they gave the go-ahead for this vaccine.
What's the rationale behind that move? And do we know whether it could make the vaccine less effective?
Britain has elected, and several countries have followed us, such as Denmark, in electing just to get the first dose out and get as many people as possible protected, as opposed to giving a second dose. So basically, we have plumped for getting as many people done in the hope that it will block transmission as well and bring things down as quickly as possible.
And that's caused some concern for people who've already had the first dose of the Pfizer vaccine, hasn't it? Because the company hasn't confirmed it's a good idea to delay.
No, what they say is that they have tested the vaccine's efficacy only for a period of 21 days. They have no proof its efficacy would last for longer. The assumption is that it will, but Pfizer has made it very clear that they can't give that guarantee. For people who've already had the first dose and were told to shortly expect the second dose, that is very confusing for them. And some doctors have said, no, we're going to go ahead and give the second dose as we promised.
Clearly, that is quite frustrating for people and there is some uncertainty. But the UK's chief medical officers seem pretty confident about this decision to delay the second dose, don't they?
I think it's the right decision. You want to get as many people done as possible.
I and all the other chief medical officers agree with this view, that the evidence is that the great majority of the initial protection comes from your first vaccination. You absolutely do need to get the second one, but that can be delayed by a few weeks. And we do not think that there will be a significant reduction in the amount of protection over that period of time.
That first dose still gives you 90% efficacy. That's a very, very good thing to have when you've got a disease that's rampant, don't forget. The R number is shooting up. Thousands and thousands of new cases a day and hospital wards filling up. We've got to do something quickly, and this is the way to do it.
I should say the World Health Organization has said that in exceptional circumstances, the second dose of the Pfizer vaccine can be delayed. They're saying by 6 weeks. As you mentioned, other countries are also increasing the gap between the two doses. Beyond that issue, how do we compare to other countries on the overall speed of the rollout?
We compare very highly. Israel's top, Denmark's very good, Germany's not so good, and France is completely rubbish.
The virus is obviously mutating, as we know, which is why we're all locked down again. And we've obviously got the new, more contagious variant here. But there is this other one from South Africa. Do we know whether the Oxford and Pfizer vaccines will be effective against those variants?
We don't know. Early tests, however, suggest that it should be all right, certainly with the new variant in Britain. People are slightly more worried about the South African variant. That's slightly more problematic, but early tests suggest that both the new variant found in Britain and the South African variant should be provided protection for by the vaccines.
And those are the two that are already rolling out. We know that there are many more in development. Moderna has been approved in the UK, although won't arrive until the spring. And there is also the Janssen one that's due to be approved soon. And the UK has ordered 30 million doses already. Tell me about them.
We're just waiting to see over the next few months all these other vaccines will come out. The Johnson one is due out soon, and it's good because it's going to be a single jab. We're going to have lots of different vaccines on our hands. It may be that one of these vaccines will be better at blocking transmission than others, in which case that's the vaccine that you might give to young people who are more likely to spread the virus. So you've got to kind of mix and match, as it were.
Coming up, even with effective vaccines, could we be in this for the long haul? Okay, so we're in a stage right now where they are pushing the rollout as fast as they think they can. Some countries are doing better than us, but as you say, some are doing worse. They've brought in the army to help.
The NHS, the armed forces, local and regional government, government at every level, are truly throwing everything at it, round the clock, if necessary.
They're hoping, not promising, that at least the most vulnerable groups will be done by mid-Feb, and then perhaps down to people who are over 60 and 50 even by late March. But is this enough? Or do we have to think about what comes next?
This is the problem, and this is what worries many scientists who don't see a long-term plan in what's going on. As you said, we hope to get all these groups done by Easter, say, get jabs into them. But that's the first dose. We then have to get the second dose in. So that's another 3 or 4 months to get them fully up to speed. You then start looking around at the other groups, and very quickly you're moving into autumn and winter coming up. And this is a winter virus. It likes this cold. You're going to come into a period of next winter where it's not necessarily the case that you've got everybody covered. Supposing you did get everybody covered, suppose you got 100%, well, they're not going to get that, but supposing you did. Don't forget, neither vaccine is completely 100% protective, even when you give two doses of it. So you're going to have a chunk of people who are still going to get this virus. You're going to get outbreaks. And that is something that we are going to have to face up to, that even next winter, we are going to be facing outbreaks of this disease, even though we've protected a huge amount of people by immunising them. And we need a long-term policy about how we contain that and how we test and how we trace. Our test and trace system in this country is a joke. So these problems haven't been solved now, despite the fact we've had this virus for almost a year. And we have to get it right. We have to get it right because it will come back next winter, hopefully in nothing like the numbers this winter, but it will reappear.
Do you know whether there's any possibility that we'll have to have this type of vaccination programme every year, that new variants will actually require new vaccines?
I think that's a very good question. I think the answer is almost entirely yes. We're going to have to. New variants will come along. Unfortunately, we can tailor these vaccines quite quickly and we can respond quite quickly. That's particularly true of the technology that's used to make the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. There's a remarkably big take-up for the flu vaccine this year, not surprisingly, I suppose. We will have to tailor our vaccines every year to target the right variants that are coming along and be prepared to live with for years.
So we can't just bring the army in every year, can we? What you're saying is we need a permanent vaccination infrastructure.
Yes, exactly. You can't bring the army in every year. You can't do what we're doing now. We have to be prepared to vaccinate against this. And if in the end of the day we have to revaccinate particularly vulnerable people every year, a bit like we do with flu, then that's fine. But the other issue is we don't know how long a vaccine will provide protection in the first place. So even if the new variants don't arrive, you still may have to revaccinate people every 2 or 3 years.
Let me ask you about that, because essentially what we've done is we've rushed through vaccinations, knowing that they're safe, knowing that they reduce harm, but not knowing other things. You've just mentioned how long they will last, but at the beginning of this interview, you mentioned the really key thing, which is whether they will prevent the spread. And ultimately, what we need them to do, given that we're not going to get 100% take up, is to drive down the R rate for society more widely. How are they going to test for that now? What is the next part of the journey here in terms of the science?
In terms of the science, we've put out, say, 1.5 million doses. What we're now looking for is a change in hospitalizations and in numbers of cases. I'm talking short term here. Over the next few weeks, a month or two, we want to know what is happening to the virus now that we're vaccinating more and more people. Now, in 2 or 3 weeks' time, we might see case numbers dropping, but we won't know, is it the vaccine doing this or is it the lockdown doing this? We just will not know. Now, there are trials, for instance, there's one at Bristol University, where they're looking at patients who have pneumonia. Pneumonia is widespread every year. At this time of year, you get lots and lots of people coming into hospital with pneumonia. And what they are doing is looking at those people who have pneumonia and COVID and looking at those patients who have pneumonia and do not have COVID. And then we'll study these ones and see how many of these groups had been given the vaccine. And if you start to see pneumonia cases coming in less and less frequently with COVID, and you see that that group also has been given the vaccine, you will know that the COVID vaccines are beginning to have an impact and they're stopping people getting pneumonia. That will be the first sign that the vaccine is making its impact. Eventually, you will see hospitalizations going down. That will be the next thing that you will look for. And that will say, yeah, it is without a doubt stopping severe cases. Finally, the death toll will start to drop after that.
Obviously, we know these vaccines will protect the most vulnerable. But how worried would you be if they don't stop the spread of COVID-19?
I think they will stop the spread. It's just a matter of how much they stop the spread.
Boris Johnson has talked about those first four groups being done by the mid-Febs. That takes us to everyone over 70. Is that going to be anywhere near enough to start our lives returning to normal?
Well, what can I say? I'm 70, so I'll get the vaccine and I'll feel safer, yes.
So it'll be good for you, Robin.
Well, it won't be good for my wife, who's not 70. So, unless I really find out, first of all, that's only the first dose, I'll need the second dose. And secondly, I will still won't know just how dangerous I am. I could be infected, not suffer any severe consequences, but I could still be infecting other people. I would still be affected by lockdown measures, social distancing. That won't change it. I'll just maybe feel a bit safer in myself.
I always think of you as like 50, but I think you probably were just over 50 when I met you. You're frozen in time for me.
I wish I was frozen in time.
And do you think, interestingly, one thing I'm just quite interested in is that, as you say, we don't know yet about the spread. So really, these jabs at the moment we know are protecting individuals. Do you think that the very nature of having a jab will change people's behaviour, perhaps make them more risky?
That is a worry. And I think people have to be told that, yeah, your chances of becoming severely ill now are much improved, but you still could be a risk to other people. You could still be passing on the virus. So please obey social distancing. So that's why, I mean, lockdowns first will go, but social distancing is going to be with us quite a long time.
And just finally, you talked about other parts of the COVID process that the government have not been successful in, test and trace, for example. How important is it for the government to get this right after so many other failures?
This is the last chance, in a sense, and it's our best chance, by the way. We have been extremely lucky in one sense in that the science has produced such good vaccines at astonishingly short notice. I think our vaccine purchasing has been extremely, extremely good, and we've got the chance to do it. So there is no excuse now for screwing this up, because if they can't get that vaccine out there in large numbers, then I don't think people will take much more of the lockdowns. This is a third lockdown, and you're not going to get away with a fourth one, really.
As a science editor, when you first saw this virus, did you have any idea about the damage it would wreak?
No, I did not think it would. I would have been stunned. I wrote my first story about this almost exactly a year ago. If I imagined sitting where I am now in a third lockdown, waiting, you know, desperately for someone to make me free, I would have been horrified at what's happened.
Well, here's hoping that in another year's time, we'll be sitting together, Robin, having a nice in-person conversation.
Please hope so. I hope so.
Robin McKee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Robin McKee, The Observer's science editor. Do buy The Observer each Sunday to read his articles, and you can find his stuff at theguardian.com. Also follow our other health and science reporters. And if you missed it, do have a listen to yesterday's Today in Focus with our health editor, Sarah Bosley, investigating the origins of COVID-19. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.